So John is going to be facilitating the discussion. And I'm going to, by the way, my name is Rich Gilman-Opowski, and I'm going to be reading from a work in progress that's called The Crisis of Coercive Authority. It's about assemblies of authority and coercion, and I'm mostly going to be talking about a thesis for anarchist political theory that I have. And I have some questions and stuff afterwards, so hopefully we can have a discussion about some of the ideas in it. So I'll just begin. So coercion is not always authoritative, and authority is not always coercive. Neither coercion nor authority, if you regard them as independent things. And I'm going to, by the way, my name is Rich Gilman-Opowski, and I'm going to be reading from a work in progress that's called The Crisis of Coercive Authority. It's about assemblies of authority and coercion, and I'm mostly going to be talking about a thesis for anarchist political theory that I have. And I have some questions and stuff afterwards, so hopefully we can have a discussion about some of the ideas in it. So I'll just begin. So coercion is not always authoritative, and authority is not always coercive. Neither coercion nor authority, if you regard them as independent things, could be said to be responsible for the most pervasive social ills and inequities. However, coercive authority, which consists in an incorporation of both coercion and authority, is what has always endangered the security or the achievement of liberties, freedoms, equity, and progress. So my argument is that because of what's required for the emergence of coercive authority, only statecraft can be its bearer. The terms coercion and authority are familiar enough, but the project here is to understand how and why authority coerces, or how authority becomes coercive or maintains itself as coercive. So I'm going to look a little bit at the Russian Revolution, very briefly, Japanese internment, and what faces us today, and ties into transnational capitalism. And I'm going to call it the culture industry, taking it a term from some other authors we'll talk about in a little bit. So basic notions, authority and coercion. Coercion is an application of force to obtain compliance. What that means is that coercion cannot be an accident. Coercion doesn't just happen by accident. And force is a product of exerting power. So when coercion takes place, what it means is that one entity coerces another. It can take place as an act or as a series of acts. If there's a board, a governing board, or an individual whose method of governance is to apply some degree of force to achieve its desired ends, then that board or individual is not necessarily coercive. Because you have to remember that even with speech, we try to achieve desired ends, and we use the force of language to do so. So coercion compels or restricts the will of the coerced. And it is therefore not enough to simply say that change results from force, because you can ask the question, is there any change that is not the result of some force? So coercion is a change that results in spite of the oppositional will of the coerced. For coercion to take place, it has to compel or restrain one to a specific act or choice that, if not for the coercion, would probably not take place. A threat, for example, is not necessarily coercion, but it's almost always an attempt to coerce. If a threat succeeds in being coercion, that means that the one threatened is compelled or restrained to some act that's intended not by him or herself, but by something outside of him or herself that's restricting his or her will. So for the success of any coercive attempt, if you want to be coercive, then having dominant or greater power at your disposal obviously is very helpful, right? Because it is an application of force. You need force to be coercive. There are also overt and covert occasions of force. of, I'm sorry, occasions of coercion. In overt coercion, the coerced notices that he or she is compelled or restrained right away. You're directly conscious of the fact that your will is being restricted by some outside force. Examples of such an occasion are parental mandates that are used to restrain a willful child, for example, or police action to enforce obedience to a law that would otherwise be ignored or opposed. In covert coercion, the coerced is psychologically affected in such a way that identifying the restriction of his or her will is difficult and only reached through some form of mediation or realization. This is a far more insidious kind of coercion, because dominant agents achieve the desired outcomes of coercion by way of undetected psychical control. Some examples. Feelings of hostility toward Palestinian groups in the Middle East on the part of the American people. Fear of violent protesters. Deep-seated yearnings for particular material acquisitions. These are often amongst the many imprints of corporate media and are more representative of the will of those who control the media than those who internalize the yearnings. Moving on to authority. Authority is not necessarily coercive. I want you to think about, just for this session, that authority could be as simple as a reliable source. As critics of both authority and coercion, we have to understand this. We only appeal to who or what we perceive as an authority for advice or information that we don't already have in ourselves. One only seeks as her tutor an individual who she takes to be authoritative in the subject matter. To do otherwise would be completely ludicrous. An authority must contain the power to influence your thinking and your acting, and for this, all it needs to be is perceived as an instructive resource. If enough people perceive someone or something as an instructive resource, that thing will be taken as an authority. Books and people and organizations and documentary films, they all can be authorities as long as they're taken as such. All argumentation, also, regardless of what it is arguing, wants to be authoritative since it seeks to be accepted as a more reasonable view than some other. And this sort of rings with what Todd May was saying about how if you had an anarchist moral commitment, that you'd kind of, the goal of it would be to say, look, our ethics system is more right on than these others. And for that to be successful, people need to perceive it as being a more authoritative perspective in the sense that it's more reasonable, it's better, it better represents reality, and so forth. But as we often learn about past authorities, authority doesn't really need truth. Before the Enlightenment, religion was the people's authority, and clerics were appealed to for direction and leadership. When people begin to accept a new authority is going to get established regardless of its truth or falsity. It's the same when you resist a new authority. For example, Copernicus, Darwin, and chiropractors, they could discover truths that eventually establish them as authoritative. But until they're accepted as such, their authority is on nothing. And that's what we mean when you hear people talking about the Darwinian Revolution or the Copernican Revolution. They're not really authorities until enough people begin to accept them as such. That's how fragile authority is. Authority is that fragile that if you stop perceiving something that's been an authority as an authority, it stops being one. To some extent, okay. Only those who place their faith in the tenets of creationism constitute the authority of creationism. Authority has to be persuasive since its success depends on people being persuaded by it. Coercion, however, this is a big difference. Coercion does not need to be persuasive. In fact, it only makes sense if it's used on the unpersuaded. I mean, you can't coerce somebody into doing something that they're already committed to doing. I mean, it would be completely superfluous. You use coercion on the unpersuaded. So the question is there something, or is there such a thing called coercive authority, right? Some kind of amalgamation of both authority and coercion. And if so, who or what can it be? We need to remember that the degree to which one can be coercive is proportionate to how much one can employ force to obtain compliance. So now moving on to the idea that the state is coercive authority or is the coercive authority. When I say state, I mean the organization that centralizes all of the legislative, judiciary, and economic supervision of a given region into a system of administration. It's a body of persons, right? They constitute a special governing class. And this governing class is established as the sovereign of a specific area, a territory, a nation. So we understand what I mean when I say the state. That the state is established as an authority is evidenced by the fact that everyone appeals to it hoping to get what we want. Everyone. We appeal to the state for justice, even when we think it is unjust itself. We appeal to the state for protection, whether it's the protection of property or a woman's right to choose. We appeal to the state for democracy, begging for campaign finance reform and third parties, even though we identify the state as excluding democracy by design. And we appeal to the state for accreditation, even though we're an anarchist institute. Now, I'm not denouncing any of these appeals. Myself, I would celebrate any relief that comes through reformist achievements. Okay? But what I'm illustrating is the distinct status of the state as a unanimously accepted authority, even if we completely transgress from the state. And we know about the trends in anarchism, primitivism. We would still understand ourselves and our achievement strictly in terms of our relation to it, this nucleus of all social order. So in every instance, we recognize the state as the nucleus of all social order. Now that the state can be coercive is evidenced by its unrestrained access to all of the different kinds of force. There once was a hope that church and state would remain separate, but it would have been no less wise to enforce a separation of industry and state. Political capital is based on the exchange of policy for funding, and all corporate contributions to political parties are really payments for services to be rendered. But here's where the covert coercion comes in. Because the state has to convince us, and unfortunately it mostly succeeds, that it's not tending to its own or other special interests, but to the interests of the general public. And because its access to force is defined by its control of the resources we need, generally speaking, we follow state dictates, hoping to be taken care of in turn. But coercive authority also compels and restrains by divulging its methods for controlling the ones who do disobey. Everyone's aware of the places and the punishments for criminals and bandits like Socrates or runaway slaves, communists in theater. Those who are indicted have not the force as individuals required to elude the state's consequences. Is the idea of the state as a coercive authority. I want to look at some examples very briefly of coercive authority, and if you can, try to think of, while I'm going through these three, other ones, other examples of authority that maintains itself through the use of coercion, the incorporation of the two. So the Russian Revolution and its critics. Okay, so I don't know how much everyone knows about the Russian Revolution. I'm just going to be pretty quick through this, and then we can talk about it if it's not clear. From 1905 to the culminating revolutions in March and November of 1917, the people of Russia organized themselves. They rose up against the ruling class, overthrowing the Tsarist and the provisional governments. The Russian Revolution is aided by a multitude of revolutionists. There were those following Lenin and Trotsky, who were in their own different ways following Marx. And there were the socialist democrats and the anarchists, too. A large international community of revolutionists spoke fervently in support of the revolution. The anarchists knew right away that Lenin was not a representative of their most prized social ideals, but nevertheless rallied support for the cause he had begun to be the face of, writing articles and speaking publicly on the subject. For the anarchists, the Russian Revolution was not the attainment of their ideals, and this was no secret. Right, but it was also considered an enormous step towards those ideals. Persons who dared to speak out against Lenin and the Bolshevik army were quickly identified as counter-revolutionary. And many anarchists who had played a significant role in overthrowing the Tsar were persecuted by other anarchists for raising questions about the justice of Lenin's methods and aims. Certain anarchists began to give voice to an emerging critique of Lenin's violent strategies and the criminalization of their comrades as bandits and counter-revolutionists. I'm going to look a little bit at what the anarchists have to say about the new authority. Nestor Makhno explained that the state achieves its most ambitious ends by, quote, resorting not only to the gun and money, but also to potent weapons of psychological pressure. And this observation is really the most poignant one, because what I want to show a little bit later is that the culture industry, which I think is the problem that we face today, the most pervasive problem that we face today, psychological force, it's often the key element in the success of coercive authorities. When an established authority is telling lies consciously to reinforce itself as the authority, its method for doing so is coercive. Then there was Emma Goldman, who arrived in Russia as a deportee from America by way of the Buford. She returned to her native land. She was eager to assist the revolutionary development of communist Russia. Let's not forget that. Very eager and excited. After 2 years, though, she fled Russia, and she began immediately and diligently criticizing the Soviet government. There was one event that really turned on anarchist criticism of the Russian Revolution, and that was the event of Kronstadt. The free sailors and workers of Kronstadt who had helped so significantly in the revolution, they started to demand from the communist state freely elected Soviets, free speech, and the sustenance and support that they were promised before the revolution. And finally, on March 7th, 1921, a rash of artillery soaked the non-combatant Kronstadters, who were only then, at that moment, roused to fight back with physical force. What Emma Goldman said was that the political power of the party, organized and centralized in the state, sought to maintain itself by all means at hand. But this is the problem. The means at hand were far greater for the Bolshevik army than they were for the Kronstadt workers. For both Goldman and Makhno, it was the massacre of the Kronstadt workers that vindicated their harshest judgment of Soviet Russia. And that's the heart of our topic. See, the Kronstadt workers were only in the capacity to appeal and defend. Now, that's what we do when we petition the state as an authority over us. Even when we have lost all of our faith in it as a democratic institution, we still persevere and appeal to it, whether it's accreditation or some other thing. We're still doing that. And that's what we have. We have appeals, right, and defenses. But Trotsky successfully urged Lenin, without much effort, by the way, not to respond with appeals, but to quell their discontent through murderous force. But for Goldman, the fact that communism and its representatives were identified as new authorities, and also for the Kronstadt workers, that is not really the crisis. That was never the crisis. That they were the new authorities was just fine. The problem was that the means of coercion completely conflicted with the principles espoused by the ultimate commitments of the new authority. And Goldman finally concluded, the methods of the state, of the Bolshevik state, as of every government, were based on coercion, which in the course of things necessarily developed into systematic violence, oppression, and terrorism. Now, moving on in history, but to a different picture of coercive authority, the internment of Japanese, Executive Order 9066. 2 months after Pearl Harbor, in February 1942, President Roosevelt issued an executive order for Japanese people in America to pick up all of the things that they could physically carry and proceed to the nearest checkpoints set up for their arrival. The U.S. was entering World War II, and Roosevelt's call for internment was to prevent anti-American activities. This is the open reasoning behind interning Japanese. We want to prevent anti-American activities. Why do we think they're going to happen? Well, because we have this racist belief that the Japanese in America are going to instinctively rise up against the U.S. in the name of some insuppressible patriotism for Japan. Executive Order 9066 excluded all people of Japanese ancestry from living in the West Coast. They were branded as potentially disloyal, and transported to relocation centers in desolate interior regions of the West. The U.S. government did not discriminate between Japanese with U.S. citizenship and those without it. They lost their homes, their farms, their sources of income, and they could not return to them after they were released from internment camp. Their jobs and homes had been taken. What the U.S. government said was that, look, it's a time of war and hostility between Japan and the U.S. You, the Japanese in America, all of you, with citizenship and without, you need to prove your loyalty to us, and allowing us to intern you will prove it. The interned Japanese, they were required to abandon all of their cultural and familial belongings, and many of them tried to be as American as Roosevelt himself could have wished. Those who did not categorically comply with the order for internment were not guaranteed any protection by their adopted government. They were always under the threat of imprisonment. Now, this example is so important because in this case, far more than in the case of the Russian Revolution, there was barely an attempt to reasonably justify internment that came from the government to the people that it victimized. It's pretty amazing. Actually, what the government said, I mean, really just laid it bare. They said that war hysteria and paranoia, I mean, were really the open insecurities. There was potential disloyalty, potential uprisings. There was really no fifth column activity at the time. There was really no massive uprising or any evidence that it was taking place. So on the grounds of war hysteria, over 150,000 people were interned and lost a great deal of their culture. The point I want to make here is that no individual could ask an entire group of people to abandon their lives in such a way that Executive Order 9066 did. In fact, forget about one individual. Think about a group of individuals. Outside of all statecraft, such an order would be completely unenforceable. With internment, we simply cannot identify authority and coercion as two distinct aspects of the state's character. We can't look at the state and say, hey, look, it's coercing us now, and at another point, it's just simply being an authority. In fact, in this case, the state became the very conflation of the two. The existence of authority was interdependent with the existence of coercion, and the success of both was contingent upon the success of the other. So now, what about when we're not dealing with occurrences as unconcealed as genocide, war, or massive human rights violations? Well, unfortunately, our critique of coercive authority doesn't really have to wait for such travesties. There's actually a more elusive coercive authority, and it convinces us every day that all is well and that the only thing to resolve is our own personal anguish. This coercive authority would have us sleep very deeply and comfortably on a national capitalist mattress and only seek to solve our problems, right, by contributing to its own strength. Using a term from Theodore Adorno in Max Horkheimer's book, Dialectic of Enlightenment, I'm going to call this coercive authority the culture industry. What is a culture industry? Well, it's to the extent that industry redefines a culture to support its own expansion, right? The industry actually defines what the culture is. It's to the extent that that happens that we're living in and under a culture industry. Now, a culture of consumption, quite clearly, is most satisfying to the interests of industry. The culture industry, as something that actually has a history, began to take shape with the introduction of mass media, starting with the radio broadcasts of the 1930s. Radio presented itself as a mode of control, since it was a conduit through which any authority could infiltrate a culture with its pronouncements. As Adorno and Horkheimer developed their critique, they watched as the German state employed radio and film propaganda to facilitate the Holocaust. And that only substantiated their worst fears. Fleeing with many others to the United States from Europe, many other radicals fleeing from Europe to the United States, they concluded after they did an analysis of the condition that they witnessed being produced under capitalism, that fascism and that totalitarianism were natural and logical outgrowths of the situation. So fascism, in Dialectic of Enlightenment, it doesn't just describe National Socialism in Nazi Germany. It describes a worldwide phenomenon characteristic of the universal course of all modern authoritarian systems that order and influence the repetitive functions of a civilization. So that which was not National Socialism, Adorno and Horkheimer said, and would still say probably even more so today, if you look at it closely enough, it is the fascistic tending towards fascism. But the culture industry's greatest achievement is when the individual's self-preservation presupposes his or her adjustment to the conditions for the preservation of the system. Its domination is not won by way of brute force, but by the imposition of its ruler's doctrine as a psychological process. Mass consciousness resonates with the success of capitalist production. Consider, for instance, this is a quote from Adorno Horkheimer, that the might of industrial society is lodged in men's minds. From every sound film and every broadcast program, the social effect can be inferred, which is exclusive to none but is shared by all alike. The culture industry as a whole has molded men as a type, unfailingly reproduced in every product. So you see yourself, we see ourselves in products. We identify ourselves in products. And what this means is that to resist the culture industry is to a very far extent to reject your identity within it. And this is why we're called radicals, because so doing, to a very far extent, makes us incompatible with the state's recreational and social features. So it's that relentless prevalence of the culture industry that forces our compliance to it, since it has become increasingly difficult to find a space in culture that hasn't been co-opted by industry. Okay, so they also say of the culture industry that it tends to make itself the embodiment of authoritarian pronouncement, it is the irrefutable prophet of the prevailing order. But the example of the culture industry is really the most critical of the ones mentioned for two reasons, I think. Firstly, we look to our culture as an authority, and we respond to its orders, and we conform to its shape, but all the while acknowledging no coercion in the process. Coercion in the culture industry consists of a purely psychological force, where recourse to more physical intervention is either unnecessary or it's unexpected. And what that means is that the modern situation under hypercapitalism is one where we are controlled sufficiently without even seeing the method of our subjection, or that we're just going to simply be really surprised by physical force if we decide to transgress more than is deemed acceptable. And two, the culture industry represents the coercive authority that is actively addressing us and working to subject us to its will in all pre-war and antebellum moments. The culture industry is the first lie that there is nothing to resist until a war, a genocide, or a massive human rights violation. And that curtails the progress of resistance. If we seek to properly comport ourselves in culture, we have to understand the culture industry. Some brief concluding perspectives on this. Throughout history, anarchism has provided poignant and nuanced analyses of the most devastating social and political problems. And I think we would all agree that today the world would really benefit greatly if it were understood more through the insights of anarchist thinking. But see, all political theory is going to attempt to understand the expanding roles of centralized political power. So anarchism can't claim that it's the only one doing that, because, by the way, all political power is centralized in the modern under modern capitalism, and more so with transnational capitalism. So an anarchist account has to distinguish itself, and I think that it does this by ultimately rejecting top-down power structures and the reforms that preserve it as such. All reformist initiatives are at the same time an acknowledgement of the fact that the state is the one authority capable of yielding the change requested. But see, anarchism cannot approach the crisis of coercive authority as do the reformers. And it cannot hope to shape our thinking unless it understands how authority is coercive in the state alone. So if you want an anti-statist philosophy or an anti-statist politics, then to me, you're looking for an anarchist theory, anarchist thinking, an anarchist project. And if we acknowledge that we have recourse to no power as magnanimous as that of the state, then we can locate in the state a capacity for malevolence that is not to be found in ourselves. That's it.